Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Now on BBC World Service, the final part of Europe's Choice. Alan Little looks how the current crisis might affect the future of the European Union.
This is what the Greek government faces in their attempts to impose austerity on the Greek people. Another day of action, another general strike by public sector workers has brought the country to a standstill. Already several thousand demonstrators have gathered here near the National Museum for a march down to Constitution Square and the country's parliament. But this is not just a revolt by Greeks against their own government. It's also a revolt by Greece itself against Europe. Because the demonstrators here have the added argument that the Prime Minister they blame for imposing austerity was not chosen by Greeks themselves, but was chosen by other European powers and principally Germany.
Germany is the one that's the locomotive of paying for other people's problems. They will probably ask to have a much bigger say in what's happening in Greece and Italy and Spain.
Peter Doukas is a former Greek budget minister. The EU was conceived, in part at least, as a way of addressing the problem of Germany's mighty weight in Europe. Integration was, its leaders thought, a way to normalise, to Europeanise Germany. For this BBC World Service programme, I'm going to ask, is this crisis in the Eurozone having the opposite effect of Germanising much of Europe?
Decisions will be made by those who actually pay for the biggest part of the bill. So the center of gravity of Europe is rapidly moving towards Berlin.
So do you think this kind of Germanization of Europe taking place?
Well, first of all, we had a customs union that benefited Germany because it could export its competitive products freely. And then you had the monetary union, and now you have a fiscal union. And in the fiscal union, they will be the ones dictating the terms with France as a junior partner.
Germany is in a position today where it is, like it or not, and the truth is it doesn't like it, in the driving seat of the European Union. Germany's never wanted to be in the driving seat. My memories of Germany in Brussels over 20 years or more is a country that was always utterly incompetent in punching its weight.
For no one is more spooked by the idea of German supremacy in Europe, by the historical resonance of that, than the Germans themselves. Quentin Peel of the Financial Times in Berlin is a veteran Europe watcher.
You have a devolution of power and a coalition system of government, which by definition means weak government. And Germans like weak government. It's not what they had in the 1930s, anything not to be back in the 30s. And I remember going to see the German ambassador in Brussels back in the 1980s. And I said, Ambassador, I really want to understand what your position is on reforming the common agricultural policy. And he said, Herr Peel, I would like to understand that too.
The European leaders who built the EU were driven by their experience of the most destructive war in human history. They wanted to answer Europe's German question. How do we stop it happening a third time? They succeeded. But there is a new, younger Germany now. This Germany resents the assumption that it'll be Europe's paymaster, endlessly picking up bills run up by feckless and ill-disciplined neighbours. The historian Timothy Garton-Ash.
The problem is that the consensus which was there 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, for making this work by moving forward to closer union is no longer there in Germany, because Germany has become a more normal country, like France or Britain.
We see clearly in polling now today that many Germans are either disappointed from Europe, or confused, or both.
Ulrike Gerow of the European Council on Foreign Relations, based in Berlin.
You have a new generation of the, let's call it the 30-something people, who are now going into the ministries, going into the media, and they have just a different narrative. You have basically still a very pro-European Germany, but a Germany that puts a price tag behind Europe. I'm still from a generation without price tag, which is Europe at any price, any condition, good for us, glue of history. This is gone.
Almost everywhere, the crisis has provoked greater suspicion of the idea of Europe, a retreat to the nations, and not just in Greece and Germany. If I'd been making this programme even 5 years ago, I'd have gone to Turkey to consider where Europe ends geographically. Turkey first applied for membership 40 years ago. But does our common European home really stretch to the borders of Iran and Iraq, to the Euphrates Valley and the fringes of Babylon? The question seems dated now. Turkey is moving on. Sinan Ulgan is a former member of the Turkish delegation to the EU.
At the time, opinion polls were showing a support of almost 75%. Since 2004, what we have seen is a gradual but clear decline in domestic support for EU membership. Today we have, according to, you know, to the opinion polls, we have about between 35 and 40% support for EU membership. So there's been a slide of almost 35 basis points.
The economic benefits of membership for Turkey are now in doubt. Over the last 10 years, Turkey's economy has grown by an average of 5% a year. Per capita income has tripled. It's now the world's 16th largest economy. In the Arab Spring, Turkey is seen as a political model to emulate, a successful fusion of Muslim and democratic sensibilities. Turkey is turning its back on a European future and forging links with a world familiar to previous generations of Turks, the Ottomans. Turkey is drawing closer to its old imperial territories.
Turkish policymakers don't like to use the term of neo-Ottomanism because it has imperial connotations. However, when you look at what's happening in practice, it is difficult to argue against that. When you look at where Turkey wants to grow its influence, it happens to coincide with the Ottoman geography. But obviously, another explanation is that really Turkey was able to take advantage of two trends in this geography. One is rising anti-Americanism after the war in Iraq. And two is really the lack of a true Arab leadership. And possibly a third one is still the continuing ineffectiveness of the EU as a foreign policy actor.
And so the shape of future Europe is shifting. In the beginning, Germany and France married their fortunes together. The European project was designed to protect German industry and French agriculture, and it served that purpose well. But that was when Germany was West Germany, with its little provincial capital at Bonn, close to the Belgian border. That Germany was easy for France to embrace.
Yeah, this is the craft shop for the mattresses, the high-temperature mattresses.
In a suburb of Berlin, the capital of a reunited Germany, Carolyn Beck is the director of a family company founded by her great-grandfather in 1874. Today, they make heat insulation equipment for power plants, amongst other things. She's one of Germany's prodigious, prolific exporters.
I would say more than 70% of my business is foreign business now.
You don't just mean not German, you mean
not German,
not European?
Not European. South America, Asia, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, all the Stan countries.
Germany is the world's second largest exporter. Exports account for a third of the country's output. And most of its exports are sold inside the EU. So Germany is probably the biggest single beneficiary of the single market and currency. But Berlin is emphatically not West Germany. It is Prussia. It faces east, beyond Europe's borders. The Germany that France married in 1957 didn't include this, wasn't nearly so eastern.
Ukraine and Russia, because it's near. It's near to our mentality. Yeah, as a Berlin company, there was always a Moscow-Berlin relationship. Two-thirds of my stuff comes from Eastern German. We are very close to the east here in Berlin. I'm sure that my grand-grandparents came from, I don't know, Poland or Russia or somewhere around the area. I don't know, but I think so.
How important will Europe be in the future to your business plans?
Not important at all, sorry to say.
In the ashes of its lost war, Germany emerged to build Europe's strongest economy. It did it on the solid rocks of fiscal discipline and a sound currency. The Germans are not alone in believing that they are being punished for their own success and prudence. Finland suffered a devastating recession in the early 1990s. They did not riot, they did not strike, they did not take bailouts from Brussels. They took their self-prescribed austerity medicine and turned their fortunes around.
We are trying to go into the government. We will negotiate with the other parties who are coming into coalition what should be the future of the European Union.
In their recent general election, a nationalist party called the True Finns took 20% of the seats in Parliament. Their message was this: why should our currency be put at risk by the behaviour of nations who did not share our pain, who chose the easy spendthrift path? Sampo Terho is a True Finn member of the European Parliament. Speaking to the BBC World Service, he says Finland made the mistake of joining the euro in a short-lived fit of naive optimism after the fall of the Soviet Union, when Finland, until then constrained by its Russian neighbour, was free at last to join the Western European mainstream.
Finland was in a sort of euphoric state.
Euphoric.
Yeah, that's right. It was sort of a great relief to finally go to the West and join everything we could. And for years and years, we were the yes men of EU, the nice guys who always wanted just to be in the core, no matter what the cost. Now, for the first time after the elections, we have started to use the word no in the EU circles, and that has caused some eyebrows to lift.
And what are you saying no to?
We are saying no to the federalism. We are saying no to giving up our independence, our sovereignty, to this, well, monster of a bureaucracy. As we all know, the Commission hasn't got a single member who is democratically elected. As we have now seen during this crisis, it is the Commission who is getting most of the powers that are now given to EU. And that is really worrying from our view. Of course, we appreciate the peace project and the things we can achieve economically and environmentally and all that cooperation that EU was made for originally. But we have went too far. We have went too far and too fast.
It was always a project devised by elites, starting with Jean Monnet, but which, with the exception perhaps of Britain and a bit one or two Scandinavian countries, did have popular support.
Sir Stephen Wall was a chief advisor on Europe to successive British governments and a renowned British European.
Here you have a group of 27 countries who, without some mechanism to unite them, A, would be very quarrelsome on trade and economic issues. That's the negative side of it. On the positive side of it, we are all democracies. We do have some shared values. And I think that in terms of trade policy and aid policy and its political stance generally, the European Union is a power for good in the world. Now, that doesn't deal with your fundamental question of how then do you get popular buy-in for it, except that I suppose you could argue that now, as in the past, if it actually delivers in terms of economic prosperity, then people will be less worried about the democratic deficit.
It's a bit like China.
Yeah, it's a little bit. Don't take that analogy too far, because it's not undemocratic. I mean, the decisions are being taken by ministers, all of whom are democratically elected. They are mandated by their parliaments.
Yes, but those democratically elected parliaments, how much power will they have in the Europe that emerges from this crisis? Almost certainly, national budgets in the Eurozone will in the future have to be submitted to Brussels for approval. Won't national populations start to say, wait a minute, this government we've elected, is it accountable down the way to us or upwards to Brussels, to an institution we haven't elected? The Finns are already saying it.
In the beginning of the 90s, we had a huge depression. We were almost in a similar shape than Greece or Portugal now. During that time, thank God, we still had our own currency. We devaluated and did a lot of savings. And in the end, we pulled through.
Europe. You're one of the richest countries in Europe.
Yes, at the moment, yes.
But do you accept that if you're in a single currency, you have certain responsibilities to the people you share, the nations you share that currency with?
Now, that is the big question. How could they sell this idea to the Finnish people in the first place and to the peoples of Europe in the first place, that we should join the euro? Part of the deal was that we do not have any sort of bailout policy. It was clearly said in the EU treaties. As we broke this fundamental rule, then we broke the original euro system.
The economic imperative is for more Europe, more fiscal discipline imposed by Brussels. There is a political backlash to this, a resistance by some of the nations, but not all.
Every time I come to Berlin, every time I see the Brandenburg Gate, I always remember the night in November in 1989 when I drove up here from Warsaw with an American journalist called Anne Applebaum. We actually arrived here in the east, then crossed Checkpoint Charlie to the other side.
Radoslav Sikorski was, in 1989, a young journalist working for a British newspaper. He's now Poland's foreign minister and one of the most interesting politicians on the continent. This is him speaking in Berlin in November. In the context of the history of these two countries, it's a remarkable speech.
I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say so, but here it is anyway. I fear German power less then I'm beginning to fear German inactivity.
Think of it, a Polish foreign minister in Berlin urging Germany to throw its weight around in Europe. It was as though he was saying, we've got over the Nazi nightmare, so should the rest of Europe.
I think it was a statement of Poland's new confidence. As you know, there is plenty of history between us and Germany. But we have carried out a successful transformation from dictatorship to democracy and from a command economy to a market economy that survived the recent crisis without a recession. So we now have the confidence to tell the Germans what their responsibility in the current situation is, and that as the biggest economy on the continent and the biggest beneficiary of the current arrangements, they have the biggest duty to do something about it.
In Poland has emerged with a stronger and stronger voice almost every year now in Europe. It's becoming more influential, more important. The centre of gravity is moving to the east. How do you see Poland's role in Europe changing in the years that lie ahead?
Well, without moving our borders for once, we have moved from Eastern Europe 30 years ago to being Central Europe a decade ago to now becoming Northern Europe in terms of our financial policies, our business culture. But you should also remember that Poland has a historic memory of itself as a largish regional country. We like to think that we've had a bad patch for a couple of hundred years, and that we are only now simply returning to what used to be.
What has Poland reached in the last 10, 15 years? Let's say a top status of the economy, of political stability. Poland is, let's say, in the heart of Europe.
Joachim Bitterlich was a senior foreign policy advisor to Chancellor Helmut Kohl and one of the architects of the single currency.
The European Union, since its inception, has been founded on the relationship between Germany and France. You can imagine in the future the German-Polish relationship becoming more important than the Franco-German relationship.
Perhaps yes, perhaps as important. Because if you take the free, there you see the mirror of Europe and at the same time the backbone. The French, in my eyes, underestimate the importance of Poland till today. The Germans, I think, Berlin has understood it. If you want, one of the advantages of being in Berlin is that relationship.
The single currency was designed to stop nations gaining an unfair advantage by devaluing. Germany has been the great beneficiary of what the Treaty of Rome called ever closer union. The true Finns are now flying a conspiracy kite that European federalists will use the current crisis as a way of binding the nations of Europe more tightly together. In fact, they're starting to say maybe that's been the plan all along.
Is it really possible that they did not see the problems of the Greeks? I've heard from a very reliable source the problems of the Greeks and even the tampering of the numbers was widely known in here, Europarliament, and it was just ignored because it didn't fit the image that the euro system is perfect. Now, when the crisis is here, the Federalists are not willing to take one single step backwards. They are trying to advance the integration even further because of the crisis.
So they're using the crisis in order to push forward the Federalist project.
Exactly. That makes me think, how far was the original Eurosystem an unintentional failure? Was it a deliberate plan to create United States of Europe at any cost?
It is a seductive conspiracy theory with a powerful popular appeal among those already inclined to Euroscepticism. You hear this in Athens everywhere, that the euro crisis is a manufactured emergency to allow foreign capitalists to pillage the country's assets. It is a Greek revolt against the European ideal. Paradoxically, Ed Balls, now the finance spokesman for the British opposition, claims he was against the euro, in part at least because he believed it would, in the long run, damage, not strengthen the European project.
I was always, and have always been, a strong pro-European. My view was that the potential stress this would mean for the European project was big and risky, but my view for Britain was always that pro-Europeanism here was too fragile to deal with the potential stress and shock of our membership. So far from being a sceptic argument about Britain's relationship with Europe, my argument was always that the pro-European cause could potentially be set back for a generation if we got this wrong. That's why it had to be proceeded with great caution.
Europe's elites want more Europe, not less. They want Germany to act, to help impose its legendary discipline on the rest of the continent. Given its history, Germany is squeamish about imposing anything. Lord Kerr, the former British ambassador to the EU.
For them, it's really important to internationalise the controls. They don't want Germans to be seen as controllers. They generally don't want to control, in my view. I think it's not just perceptions, it's reality. But that drives them to wanting a bigger Brussels. And that is not popular in Paris, and clearly very unpopular in Britain.
For this series for the BBC World Service, I've drawn this conclusion. The Eurozone countries now face a clear choice. Force some countries to drop out of the single currency and retreat to national silos. Or lock more tightly together and surrender more sovereignty, especially over tax and spending, to Brussels. The choice it makes will be made, in effect, in Berlin. The project began in the 1950s as a way of Europeanizing Germany. Half a century on, the fate of the continent lies in the hands of a reluctant German chancellor.
Europe's Choice was presented by Alan Little and produced by Jane Beresford.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.